Welcome to Feedback Friday. I'm your host, Jordan Harbinger, and I'm here with producer Jason DeFilippo. On the Jordan Harbinger Show, we decode the stories, secrets, and skills of the world's most brilliant and interesting people and turn their wisdom into practical advice that you can use to impact your own life and those around you. This week, we had Wendy Bahari talking about narcissists and how to disarm them, whether we know one or perhaps even live with one. And Chris Bailey was here talking about hyperfocus and how in order to solve complex problems, sometimes it's best to actually not focus at all. I also write every so often on the blog. The latest post is how to help people change for the right reasons. We all want to change someone in our lives, whether we live or work with them. And this article shows us when and how we can accomplish this most daunting of tasks. So make sure that you've had a look and listen to all of that. And the articles, of course, are at jordanharbinger.com/articles. Of course, our primary mission is to pass along our guests' insights and experiences and our experiences and insights along to you. In other words, the real purpose of the show is to have conversations directly with you. And that's what we're going to do today here on Feedback Friday. You can reach us at friday@jordanharbinger.com. Well, we got a bunch of good ones. Let's dive right in this week. Jason, what's the first thing out of the mailbag?
Hi, guys. Last night, I very stupidly forgot to lock my car before going out. I parked in a parking structure with pretty heavy security. When I came back today, I noticed that stuff was thrown around in my car, and my backpack with my work laptop was gone. Security came and said they caught the guy in the act, and they had my backpack. He got another unlocked car, too, but they recovered everything, and I got way too lucky. At first, I figured it was some younger person trying to get some extra money, but it turns out it was a vagrant in his 40s who's currently in jail because of other warrants. So I'm having big doubts about pressing charges, since I can only imagine an extra felony on his record isn't going to help him. On one hand, like I said, it's probably not going to help or deter him, but on the other, it feels weird to let someone get away with a crime that I despise and is a big problem in the area. The hassle of pressing charges doesn't matter to me, but whether or not pressing charges is going to help or even worsen things is what I'm confused about. What would you guys do? I'm leaning towards not pressing charges because a vagrant in his 40s in Detroit probably has enough problems to deal with. Thanks for any help. Signed, Not Perry Mason. I'd just like to say, first off, what the hell are you doing leaving a laptop in a car in Detroit? Or actually anywhere for that matter. I mean, never, ever leave anything in your car, man. Ever.
Yeah, good point. I grew up in Detroit, or at the outside of Detroit, and I worked in Detroit for a while, Detroit proper. And I will say, leaving something in your car, don't even leave like a shirt, depending on where you are in the city, because people might assume there's something under it. It's hiding something. I've had my car broken into so many times in Detroit, even in secured lots. It's just the city's not doing too good when it comes to a lot of folks, and a lot of folks are desperate. But you're right. Pressing charges could be a waste of time. I actually caught a bike thief in the act in San Francisco. I caught a guy breaking into a building, going into a bike room that was sort of separate from an apartment building, pushing himself under a gate, using tools to smash locks. I called the police. I waited in a place where he couldn't see me. I called the cops. Cops came, caught him with burglary tools in his hand. They had their guns drawn. He slid out and he got arrested, and he still ended up getting off with time served after he skipped bail the first time. I mean, this is a loser, okay? And he still got off because I got his ethnicity wrong. And I'm like, well, he was wearing a mask and it was at night. And so I said that he was dark complected, and they're like, would you say he's African-American? I was like, I don't know, I guess so, maybe. And it turned out that he was like dark Hispanic guy. And they were like, well, you can't positively identify him. And I was like, it was the guy that they caught with the burglary tools sliding under a gate with their guns drawn. And the jury, even though the cops saw the guy the whole time from start to finish, and so did I, and never took our eyes off him, they were like, well, he's already been in jail for a month, not guilty. So juries are dumb as hell. And so, yeah, he could get away with this. You could just waste some public resources. It's ridiculous. Then again, if this is a vagrant in his 40s with other warrants, I would say he's probably better off in prison. I know that sounds harsh, but look, he probably can go to drug rehab. It's harder for him to hurt himself or anyone else in prison. This is a person that cannot take care of themselves. This is why we call inmates wards of the state. The state is taking care of them. I know that the prison system needs work, but it's easier for people to get off substances in prison because they have food and shelter and they can ask for help if they want it. Sure, they might have access to drugs, but they can get off of them if they want. In fact, a lot of inmates credit prison with help for getting them clean. So it's not an ideal environment for anyone, of course, but it might be easier if the person is trying to get a place where they can sleep for the night, food and shelter, it's cold or hot, and they don't have anything to eat. prison takes care of those problems. If you don't press any charges and they keep robbing people, you're not really helping him. And you're definitely not preventing this sort of crime. This guy cost you thousands of dollars. If it was up to him and he didn't get caught, he would have stolen your laptop, broken things in your car, taken your money, whatever he could get his hands on. This guy might rob 20 cars a day. He might cause thousands of dollars in damage every single day. Do you want to enable that or do you want to help prevent it? Sure, in my situation, I might not have won that one with the bike thief, but the guy has a record now. He might also think twice because, yeah, he got off on this one, but he spent a few months in jail awaiting trial because after he skipped bail, they didn't give him bail the next time and he was stuck in jail. So they gave him time served, which is potentially a deterrent. And look, like I said, this is San Francisco. A lot of people don't get punished because society and oppression and other buzzwords that we treat criminals like babies instead of like criminals. But the way that I look at it, and I'm not a law and order type of guy here in terms of like harsh justice, but I would say anybody who's making a career out of breaking other people's stuff and stealing it, they've got other problems and you're not helping them by letting them get away with it. They got there in the first place because they're getting away with it. They need consequences, and those consequences aren't necessarily going to be punishment. They're going to be the opportunity for him to be in a place where he doesn't have access to drugs 24/7. A lot of people who've been to prison might be chuckling about that, but they have less access to drugs and they have access to substance abuse programs if they need them. I mean, this is a person that is honestly better off incarcerated than they are to their own devices, in my opinion.
Throw the book at him.
Look, he doesn't have to go to jail for 20 years. He could get 90 days, but that could be what he needs to not do heroin 50 times a day, right? That could give him the springboard that he needs. And also, frankly, deterrence doesn't work with drug addicts because they're sick. He needs to get that part cured. And if there's a way that they can put him into an inpatient rehab facility instead of just prison, that would be ideal. Because he's probably sick. He's probably not a guy who enjoys robbing people at age 40 in Detroit. I mean, he's a nonviolent criminal here, or so we know. So this is somebody who I would say should be treated like they are sick. You don't treat someone who's sick by saying, well, we might have some treatment for you, but I'm just not going to pay attention to it because I got my laptop back. And I don't think you're thinking like that. I think you're thinking, do him a favor. You're not doing him a favor by letting him get away with it. Think about this. If he was 14 years old and he did this, would you think, yeah, he's 14, I'm not going to do anything? Or would you say, ooh, he's 14, it's time for him to learn that you can't break into people's cars? I think we should treat him like somebody who can't help himself, because I don't think he can. All right, next up.
Hey, J.Crew, congrats on the healthy baby boy. My husband is an extremely loyal and hardworking person. At his last job, he worked tirelessly to support an entire department under a frazzled and checked-out manager. The company laid off almost all of their employees until they were operating with a slim skeleton crew, and he still managed to meet the company's goals. Despite my coaxing to get off the sinking ship, he stayed on until they laid him off as well. Thankfully, he accepted a job offer within a couple months of being unemployed. That was almost a year ago. Fast forward to today. He seems to love the work he does and is very qualified. He's received praise from the owner for tripling production output and putting new systems into place to increase efficiency since he started the job. The issue is a coworker of his we'll call Brad. The two of them used to be very friendly from what I can tell, and I've met the guy and even met his family. Recently, all I hear are stories about Brad undermining my husband every opportunity he gets, pointing out small mistakes to managers while Brad disposes of his own, telling managers that my husband isn't a team player when the two of them have already agreed on the order of events and what should get priority, complaining to colleagues and managers about the new systems behind my husband's back, etc. My husband has voiced these concerns to a supervisor and the owner of the company at a recent performance review, and they said they would work to correct it. However, now Brad has a chip on his shoulder and is out for blood. He's been with the company longer, and his supervisor loves him. Even the supervisor has chimed in with Brad at times. I've tried to tell him that he needs to bring the dynamic to his boss's attention again, but he doesn't want to seem like he's the common denominator. I hate to see him become the victim of a hostile work environment, especially when he otherwise loves his job. I jokingly say, "You want me to beat him up?" And that always gets a chuckle, but I'm at the end of my rope here. What to do? Any advice is appreciated. Signed, Stuck Between a Rock and an A-Hole.
Nice. First things first, whenever you're getting into a situation like this at work or anywhere else, document everything, including getting Brad's sign-off. So you might do something like, or he might do something like, okay, here's the plan, this is what we're going to do, da-da-da. Then he writes a nice email to Brad confirming that that's what they just discussed. So that later on, when Brad complains, your husband has a written record of it all. And he can say, well, if that wasn't the plan, then how come when I sent my confirmation email 5 minutes after the meeting, you didn't respond with, hey, that's not what we talked about at all? How come you either replied with okay or you didn't reply at all? You got the email, right? You do check your email. I would imagine that a work email system can see who opens what if it came down to it, but it shouldn't matter. Your husband should also start looking for another job as a fallback or safety measure here. This way, if things get bad or worse, he has the keys to the prison, so to speak. He can tell his boss that he's thinking of leaving because of this, and then he'll see what his company's made of. By the way, never threaten to leave unless you can and are ready and willing to do so. Because what you might find is if he's like, look, I'm thinking about leaving because of this, they might be like, oh, good, this is a good opportunity to fire you. We weren't going to do that right away, but now that you mentioned it, maybe we should do that. You know, that could push people over the edge. You don't know where you stand. So unless you can leave, are ready and willing to do so, don't threaten to leave. Documenting. Write down important conversations and events that illustrate your argument. So include the time, the date, the names of other people who are around, everything. So if you have a meeting with Brad, or if he has a meeting with Brad, have him write down the salient points and put in an electronic copy of this, not on his work computer. He should write it down in his phone. You can share it with HR or people at work later. What you don't want is, oh, this is all on my work drive and an email, and then can I have a copy of that? No, you can't, because you're being terminated or you're under performance review. You don't want to not have access to this, especially if it goes to court or you want to show somebody and your boss doesn't want you to. Save all emails where you've contributed original ideas and work. You know, if someone's taking credit, if Brad starts taking credit for your husband's work, make sure your husband prints those emails out. Now, you might not be able to remove things from work. There could be rules against removing things from work, but maybe you can forward something to a personal email. Sort of depends on company policy. Probably you should check on that. But if you print off that stuff, that way, if work accidentally loses those emails or you need to find them later, you've got a nice little file on your desk in a locked drawer that says Brad, right? And you've got backups of that if needed. Ideally, you have an electronic copy of your own, but you got to check with work. Make sure you don't get fired for forwarding work stuff to yourself about stuff at work. That would be a pretty dumb way to blow through a company policy. And before confronting your boss about the issue, talk with other coworkers, because I don't know what the size of the company is or anything, but there might be other people that have issues with Brad that haven't said anything. And this will help you determine if he's undermining you or just your husband, or if it's a general issue among the other coworkers. I've found with a lot of people that undermine, I've found from asking and going through this a lot and seeing this in my inbox on the Jordan Harbinger show a lot, that if someone's undermining one person, they're often undermining 2, 3, 4, or 5 people. And sometimes people who like to undermine, they will undermine anyone who's not them, which is a tactical mistake. So ask your coworkers, hey, does Brad forget to include you on important emails? Or does Brad ever say negative things behind your back? Or, hey, Brad told me something really negative about you the other day. Has he ever said anything about me? And you can start to compare notes and find, oh, Brad is a shit talker with literally everyone in the office. Go figure. Now, if 2, 3 of you are going to 1 or 2 managers and saying, hey, this guy is talking smack about everybody, it makes Brad look bad, because why else would you team up with different people from the same or different departments? It just doesn't make sense. Try to keep the problem transparent as well. If you're emailing Brad, or if your husband is emailing Brad, CC the boss on email communication. Here's the meeting we just went to. Here's the plan we decided on. CC the boss. You can BCC, but CC is better, because now he knows he can't do anything. However, if he wants to trap Brad in a lie, you can send a confirmation and BCC the boss. And then if Brad goes, he's doing all these things we didn't agree on, your boss can go, that's interesting, because I was BCC'd on the email follow-up, and you don't know that, but now I know you're lying. Also, if Brad keeps forgetting to inform your husband about important meetings or something like this, which is a classic undermine tactic, send an email to everybody in the meeting. Include the information and the ideas that you would have provided at that meeting or anything you would have wanted to discuss at that meeting, and ask the whole attendance list to invite you in the future and CC your boss in the email. Hey, looks like I was somehow overlooked for this morning's staff meeting about the new client. Here's what I would have contributed. Here are some questions I have. Next time, would somebody mind double checking that I'm invited to this? I would love to attend next time. That way, everyone knows that you weren't invited for some reason. And maybe next time someone will remember. That makes it really hard for someone to keep forgetting to invite you, or to not invite you and then claim that they did and that you didn't show up, which is another classic underminer tactic. Your husband can also talk to Brad directly. Do so, though, in a non-confrontational way. Document that talk and then send a follow-up email outlining the discussion to Brad, and then either CC or BCC the boss. That's your call. So, hey, Brad, I know that we've had some disagreements in the past about how to execute things. I thought we were all on the same page. Here's what I want to do in the future to avoid this. We need to be more transparent. Let's meet every Monday at 6 a.m., whatever the hell you want to do. CC the boss. That way, the boss can see that you're trying to solve the problem. And then when Brad whines about how this isn't working, he can go, wait, didn't you guys decide to have a meeting? Oh, yeah, well, he's not doing the meetings. Well, that's funny because I keep seeing him inviting you to these meetings in the calendar. So what's going on? And then the truth will slowly start to come out, because a lot of people who undermine, they're not evil geniuses. They're throwing crap at the wall to see what sticks. They've been doing this since high school, and they're not always experts at this. If they were really smart, they would be good employees most of the time, and they would find out how to outwork you and outcompete you in a fair way. These usually are people that slack at their jobs, and they want to make you look worse by design so that they're the last man standing for a promotion. Rarely is this such a nefarious and in-depth detailed plan, so you can almost always catch them in their BS if your boss is paying attention and if you're documenting everything. If Brad thinks he's getting away with this and he's being stealth, now he's on notice with the emails. Many times people who undermine, they're cowards, they're going to pick an easy target. If he's not, and now he's out for blood, as you say, then it's Brad or your husband, right? If it comes down to this. If people at work won't have your husband's back, he should move on. Brad will get fired eventually because he'll keep doing this sort of thing to the next guy and the next guy and the next guy. And eventually bosses are going to be like, wait a minute. Oh, I see. Now you're undermining me. Ooh, I wonder if this is what happened with so-and-so. It sucks to leave your job. And I would say try strengthening your relationship with your boss first. The way that you can do this is schedule regular meetings with your bosses to discuss your performance. It'll get you closer to your boss. Yes, you probably have regular performance reviews, but they will see you're genuinely caring about your job and that you want the best for the company. It depends on your boss's schedule, but look, if you can meet with your boss twice a month, every other week, that's pretty good. That's probably more than Brad's doing. And when Brad meets with them, he's probably whining and complaining and trying to undermine you. If you're meeting with them and you're trying to improve and you're not just complaining about Brad the whole time, it starts to be really obvious that you care about your job and Brad cares about undermining you. There's a huge difference there. If you talk to the boss about this, though, make sure you keep the focus on Brad's behavior and not on Brad as a person. Focusing on him as a person will undermine your credibility. Oh, he's just such a jerk and he's rude and da-da-da. No, we want, yeah, Brad agrees to things and then changes his mind and it screws up the plan. And I mean, I can show you instances where this has happened. Here's the meeting, here's the plan, here's the email. And then I know that he told you that this wasn't the plan, but here's the email right after the meeting. If you focus on his behavior, it looks like you're looking out for the company, not just looking out for yourself. And if you can meet with your boss and bring another negatively affected coworker to that meeting, make sure your boss approves of that, by the way, so they don't think they're just meeting with you and then you bring someone else. If you bring another coworker who also is negatively affected, someone who Brad is also smack-talking, then they can vouch for you and it's not your word versus his. But at the end, if your husband's boss won't have his back, it's worth it to go somewhere that doesn't tolerate slash foster a toxic work environment. Make a statement by leaving. Let your boss know why. It doesn't have to be bitter. It can be, hey, I've brought these things to your attention. I feel like I'm not being supported here. I'm going to go somewhere because I think that there's a toxic work culture here. I hope you don't find out the hard way. I hope things do work out for you. I'd love to come back in the future, but I can't work with a company that looks at all this toxic work environment and doesn't do anything. And just keep it really unemotional. Once Brad gets fired because he does this to another person or 10 at work, your husband can come back. He can probably negotiate a better offer anyway, if he even feels like coming back. Because look, yeah, it sucks. He likes his job, but you have to look at management. If they really don't believe him slash don't care that there might be a toxic work culture because Brad's so fun and he's great at squash, then get the hell out of there. It's just not worth putting up with that crap. If they don't care about the company, why should he?
Who the hell plays squash anymore?
A lot of people play squash.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I know. All right, what's next?
Hello to the 4Js. I'm a real estate investor who works for a big corporation to pay the bills. I'm in marketing and have been working at the same company for over 11 years now. I haven't advanced my career, and it's not from a lack of trying. After a lot of failed attempts, I got complacent and gave up, a decision I regret and one that I'm trying to change. I hear of coworkers getting a promotion because they're quote-unquote smart. What does it mean to be smart? Is being smart related to IQ? Is it related to emotional intelligence? Or is it having all the above? I have to ask coworkers, bosses, and friends, what makes someone smart? Most of the time, people don't say anything in response. I get a lot of blank stares. I would really like to know what you think about this. I have a BA from an Ivy League art school. I taught myself different programs over the years so I could do my job the best way I can. On paper, though, I don't come across as smart. I don't think of myself as dumb, but I also don't think of myself as smart either. Maybe because I don't know what it means to be smart. Thank you. Signed, looking for the answer. Well, I can tell you right now, IQ doesn't matter very much because it's been widely debunked for starters. And look, I test between 138 and 141, depending on the hangover that day. Hmm. And I also tested in the 99th percentile on my Mensa exam. But most of my friends, even you, Jordan, will tell you that most of the time I'm dumb as a post. So IQ, you can take out of the equation.
I don't think you're dumb, but I am surprised to hear that you tested in the 99th percentile for a Mensa exam. I look at those Mensa exam questions and I'm like, I don't even know what you're asking me. Fold.
Yeah, to me, they're basic. I don't know why. It's just my brain works the way the Mensa exam works, and I can just fly through those things.
That's funny. I remember looking at that, I think, in college, and I was just like, I have no clue. What is this, like a logic puzzle? I'm done.
Yeah, I tested in my junior year in high school, got in the 99th percentile, but we didn't have any money. We were living in a hotel, so I couldn't afford the dues. And then I tested again in my 20s, and I hit 99th again. And then by that point, I'm like, you know what? I like going out and partying and going to punk rock shows. I don't think Mensa's probably my crowd.
There's probably a ton of people in Mensa that like doing that, by the way. It's probably full of people that are on weird alt cultures and stuff like that.
That's true.
Yeah, who knows? Well, what could have been, Jason? What could have been?
What could have been? Coulda, shoulda, woulda.
So who knew JPD was a genius? Honestly, here I'm just reading between the lines, though, with this question. I'm making assumptions here, so I could be way off, but my gut says you're just not well-liked in the office. And I apologize if this stings a bit, but the image I'm getting from what you're telling me from this question is that you might lack some social intelligence and people are actually just annoyed by this. For example, nobody gets promoted because they're smart. This is a reason people might give when they don't feel like telling you why someone got promoted over you, or because they don't really know, they just like the other person better. If they don't feel like giving you a concrete answer, or maybe you've heard the answer 100 times and you refused to accept it, I'm not saying you're doing this, but I think a lot of people go, oh, well, Jim's really smart. So it's easier than saying, well, Jim's intelligent and he handled this project well, and frankly, nobody wants to work with you on this kind of thing because you're really annoying and you talk about how you tested in the 99th percentile and Mensa all the time and that gets old really fast. You know, who knows what the reason is? I'm making assumptions here. Again, like I said, they might just like the other person better. That's why most people get promoted. They do their job decently, but they're better liked. They have better people skills. It's also possible that you come across as distracted or you come across as checked out compared to most, possibly because of your side hustle. I mean, if people in the office know that you have the job with them, quote unquote, to pay the bills, they might not like the sound of that too much. It sounds like you think you're too good to be there with everyone else. Maybe. And nobody wants to promote somebody who's only there for a paycheck. If you think you are really getting pigeonholed as this, if people know about your side hustle, you might be better off switching jobs if you're feeling stuck. And I know it seems like I'm telling everyone to quit today, and that's an unfortunate coincidence. But if you want a clean slate, something new is often the best way to get it. Trying to fix the impression you've made on everybody for the last 11 years is going to be pretty impossible. But if you switch to something new and you go, ah, okay, I need to not run around talking about how I'm a millionaire real estate investor or something like that, or tested well in Mensa, or this is just my side hustle, I'm too good for this marketing job. Again, I don't know if you're doing any of that, but if you're doing any of what you wrote in this letter around the office, or people are reading between the lines and getting that kind of feel, I can see why you're not getting promoted. Otherwise, perhaps ask some folks in the office that you trust for their honest opinion. If they're avoidant or they just say, well, it's because so-and-so is smart, then ask them if they think you are not smart or not qualified and why. I mean, we're pretty limited on info here and we can't really get any more detailed info for you. And I'm not trying to call you names. Don't take that away from this. I don't know anything about you, but when I hear that other people are getting promoted over you and everyone stares at you blankly when you ask why, and it seems like the reason is smart and you don't know the definition of smart, I'm getting a weird sort of vibe that maybe you just lack a social understanding and can't read between the lines. My gut says, based only on this letter, that you're not well-liked in the office. I can only really speculate as to why that might be. So if you have other insight on that, then I would explore that and not worry about the definition of the word smart among people around you. Clearly, you're an intelligent person. I mean, you listen to this show, so that's Mensa material right there if I've ever seen it. All right?
It is. And I think you nailed it on the head. I just think he's probably 11 years being there and checked out, just doing it for the paycheck. And other people are there hustling and they care about the company and really want to make a difference.
Yeah.
I think that's really what it is. Has nothing to do with intelligence. Maybe social intelligence, but not, you know, book smart intelligence.
Yeah, because nobody goes, oh, well, that guy's smart. We're going to promote him. I mean, it's just kind of like, ugh, you're really asking this question? Oh, well, he's smart. Am I not smart? No, you're smart too. I got to go. I mean, they don't want to have the conversation with you is what it sounds like.
Yep.
Smart is the throwaway, leave me alone, I'm going to Chipotle answer.
With everybody else in the office but you.
Right, yeah, exactly. Yes, going to Chipotle with everybody else in the office. Yeah, so when they go, oh, well, of course he got promoted, everyone likes him, they don't want to say that because then you'll go, what, people don't like me? And then they're like, I gotta pee, bye. You know, they know that that's going to result in a conversation that they don't want to have, so they're just going to avoid you.
This is Feedback Friday. We'll be right back after this.
This episode is sponsored in part by HostGator.
Let's say Ted Koppel is your favorite broadcast journalist of all time, so you want to honor his legacy and maybe make a modest fortune with a line of action figures featuring the intrepid reporter in various states of newsworthy peril. Safari Koppel, Freedom Fighter Koppel, Deep Sea Koppel. Sure, they're targeted towards an extremely niche audience, but you have faith your Koppelgangers will capture the imagination of fellow Nightline junkies, ironic hipsters, and savvy collectors around the globe. But how are you going to reach this audience? Thanks to HostGator, you can tell the world about your ludicrous business idea without possessing the deep pockets of a major broadcasting network. HostGator is where you can register your own unique domain and hawk your wares online with supreme ease and low overhead. HostGator's 99.9% uptime guarantee and around-the-clock support ensures your website is available to the eyes of the world every day and night of the year. Got a tight budget? No worries. As long as you're a new user, you get to try any HostGator package for up to 62% off the normal price just for hearing the sound of my voice. And if you're not completely satisfied with everything HostGator has to offer, you've got 45 days to cancel for a refund of every last penny. Check out HostGator.com/Jordan right now to sign up. That's HostGator.com/Jordan.
This episode is also sponsored by Rocket Mortgage.
Support for the Jordan Harbinger Show comes from our friends at Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home is so much more than a house. It's your own little slice of heaven. That's why when you find the perfect place for you and your family, getting a mortgage shouldn't get in the way. Finding the right house isn't easy, but finding the right mortgage can be. Rocket Mortgage is doing more to help you understand the home buying process so you can get exactly what you need. Because it's not just a mortgage, it's your mortgage, and they found a better way. Their team of mortgage experts is obsessed with finding a better way, which means that their number one goal is to make the home buying process smoother for you. They make the home buying process work for you. In fact, Rocket Mortgage is there with award-winning client service and support every step of the way. Quicken Loans has helped millions of Americans achieve their dream of home ownership, and when you're ready to purchase the home of your dreams, they can help you too. When you work with them, you get more than just a loan, because Rocket Mortgage is more than just a lender. Visit rocketmortgage.com/Jordan and take the first step towards the home of your dreams. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org number 3030. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Push button, get mortgage. Thanks for listening and supporting the show. To learn more about our sponsors and get links to all the great discounts you just heard, visit jordanharbinger.com/deals. And if you'd be so kind, please drop us a nice rating and review in iTunes or your podcast player of choice. It really helps us out and helps build the show family. If you want some tips on how to do that, head on over to jordanharbinger.com/subscribe. Now let's hear some more of your questions here on Feedback Friday.
Next up, this one's pretty interesting, Jason.
Dear JJJ and Little J, I'm a 30-year-old Italian expat living in New Zealand. After repeating several years of high school due to lack of attendance and wasting 2 years in college on a course I wasn't interested in, I started working at entry-level jobs in hospitality to save up for what I thought was my only calling in life, traveling. I ended up traveling all over Europe and finally ended up in Australia, of all places, for a year. I struggled to find even the most basic job despite my experience in hospitality and the fact that I speak four languages. I've always been told how I lacked drive and determination in my school career, In at home and retrospectively, that was definitely true. I finally found work as a farm worker, and that, I assure you, was no walk in the park. It taught me valuable lessons about hard work and gave me a boost in self-esteem. After having to leave the country due to my visa expiring, I moved to neighboring New Zealand. Here I started meeting people that were genuinely believing in me, as I had inadvertently built an interesting stack of skills, and I felt I found my home. This was also where I met my now girlfriend of 3 years and no doubt the love of my life. This also was when I discovered your podcast, and I used to listen for hours on end at work as a construction laborer. I gained some very valuable knowledge in this sector as well as gardening and cleaning, and in 2018, I found that it was time to try and start my own little business. I did keep my day job, as you pointed out, and I built my own wheelie bin cleaning setup from scratch in my backyard. That's a dumpster for you Americans. After about a month of cleaning people's bins after work, I got so much work that I had to dial down my hours at my day job to keep up with demand. After a year in business now, I find that there's almost no competition in my city. Demand is going through the roof, and I get an overwhelming amount of positive feedback from clients. I earn 3 times as much as I used to, and life is great. I'm reaching full capacity soon, and spring is just around the corner. What's your take on my situation as a startup owner without previous business experience? New Zealand is where the new American dream is at. Starting a business is easy and competition in many areas is limited. Other people will likely see the profitability of my niche, and I want to avoid a race to the bottom price-wise with multiple potential competitors. Should I try to win over all the big commercial contracts as soon as possible to establish my position in the city and do some guerrilla marketing along the lines of Brian Scudamore? Shall I get employees and risk to fail due to hiring the wrong people? Or should I consider franchising my brand as customers trust me and my expertise so far has proven to be valuable and will help me train and motivate new franchisees to attain freedom and success as I've done? Yours sincerely, Living It Up Down Under.
To answer this question, I actually wanted to bring in my friend Cameron Harold. He was on the show earlier this year talking about bipolar and how it can be a superpower, but he was also the COO of 1-800-GOT-JUNK. And this question is right in his wheelhouse. So I'm going to help him help you.
Wow. Okay. So first off, I'm kind of vibrating in my seat. I was excited when you started reading this guy's question and we're just talking about his traveling and some of his learning. And I started listening to his words. He's a really great writer. He's just
articulate. It struck me now. He just said he's Italian and he speaks 4 languages. If this is his English, I'm a little jealous.
Can you work for me and write for me?
Seriously.
I'm really impressed with his writing and his ability to market himself and communicate his skills. I didn't know he'd started a business, but what I was going to say is for him to start getting into the entrepreneurial community with some written posts, some written blogs, some written articles that he can share so that people can see kind of what he's learned and almost to debrief with himself over his last couple of years, because he's got some huge skills. But then he pointed out he's already done that. It'll never be the race to the bottom if you don't allow it to be. Keep your prices high. Choose to be that kind of FedEx or the Starbucks of whatever space that you're in. You know, when we built 1-800-GOT-JUNK, we wanted to be the FedEx of junk removal. We talked about being the Starbucks of junk removal. One of the first things I did coming into that company was raised our prices 35 to 40% so that we would be way higher than everyone else in the industry, but we could actually deliver better service, better marketing, better branding, better customer experience, and better employee experience because we could afford to. There were 17,000 independent junk businesses when we really launched 1-800-GOT-JUNK. So we didn't even create an industry. So don't worry about competition or race to the bottom. In every single industry, someone is choosing to be the premium price. You know, even if you think about Starbucks of coffee today, there's hipster coffee shops 3 blocks away from every Starbucks that are charging 30% more than Starbucks are for a latte now. You know, Starbucks used to be the premium and they're no longer. They're kind of at that middle to maybe 70th percent of the bell curve. If you think about the space that you're in, it's just time to start hiring, right? Really turn this into a business with lots of employees so that you've got, before you franchise, I would try to get this to a business that's at least doing $500,000 to $1 million a year in revenue. So I'm not sure what your revenue mark is, but to truly be a successful franchisor, you need to make sure your franchisees make a lot of money. And that was what I'd done with a few different businesses was as long as my franchisees made a lot of, and by a lot of money, they have to make at least $250,000 a year in profit off running a franchise so that they can truly replace a great career job and not so that they're kind of buying themselves a $40,000 job like a Subway franchisee, right? Where it's a Subway franchisee and they've got three of their relatives working there because it's the only way they can pay the bills. That's not a successful franchise type model. And it's why a company like Quiznos went out of business, was they were good at selling franchises, but they weren't good at everybody making money off of it. So I would make sure that your current business is big enough, profitable enough, start hiring people to do the work for you so that you can continue to build out the brand. I do like the idea of tying up the contracts, tying up the business relationships, and then ask yourself really where you want to take this over time. Like, what is your goal for this 3 years, 10 years out? Is it to build something to sell? Is it to build something to operate? Because franchising is a very expensive kind of a model. It's a tough model to actually make money in. And there's a high, what I call pain in the ass factor, a high PETA factor. So just make sure that you consider what you're building and why you're building it and how long you're going to be building it for. There's a lot of legal, there's a lot of restrictions, and you could build, you know, $100 million system-wide business, but because your top-line revenue is only your royalty, you're really only a $10 million business. So you don't have as big of an exit opportunity. I look at doing a hybrid model instead of franchising. If you're going to expand and you want multiple locations, multiple cities, see if you can do some joint ventures where you bring on some people's money. They have the financial stake, but you take all the operational side of the business and you kind of go with a general partner, limited partner type model where maybe they help you open two cities. They own 50% of those two cities. They have no operational say in the business. You get 100% operational say. They have the financial risk, and then you build the business more in that kind of a hybrid model than a pure franchise model. So I would start with, where are you going? What are you trying to build long-term? And then reverse engineer that. Don't just go from, hey, I have a cool concept, to I should franchise. Starbucks never franchised, right? Starbucks is a corporate model. And Cobb's Bread, which is a successful business out of Australia, did a joint venture, a limited partnership type model to expand. There's all kinds of ways to grow to multiple locations without being a franchisor. Even when we did Boyd Auto Body and Gerber Auto Collision, we acquired all these businesses and then took the company public. So I would just think of different ways to have multiple cities, multiple locations up and running, because franchising can be a fast way to grow, but a high pain in the ass factor as well.
Special thanks to Cam Harold for dropping by and helping us answer that question. You can hear the episode I did with Cameron Harold a few weeks ago here on the Jordan Harbinger Show. We'll link to that in the show notes as well. And we'll link to the episode with Brian Scudamore, who was the CEO and co-founder of 1-800-GOT-JUNK, if you're interested in listening to that as well. Okay, next up.
Jordan, is it ever good to name drop when networking? Signed, don't want to be a douche.
I've gotten this question a lot recently because of the 6-minute networking class, and I think it's a really, really good question. A lot of people name drop. Let me ask you this. When someone name drops, are you impressed? Most people aren't. In fact, I was at a Tony Robbins event.
Name drop?
That was not the name drop. And on stage, he's like, yeah, I was hanging out with Dan Quayle, and we were flying on George Bush's jet, and we were da-da-da-da with Mark Benioff from Salesforce. And I was just like, okay, we get it. And people in the crowd were mesmerized, in part because Tony's larger than life, and he's on stage. And a guy next to me goes, wow, normally this would be name dropping, but Tony's so badass. And I was like, oh, look, isn't that funny? You literally see and recognize this. Your brain recognizes this as name dropping, but you're giving him a pass because of his status. Unless you have massive amounts of social status, like you're on stage in front of 11,000 people, you probably are coming across ridiculous when you name drop. So here's the rule for name dropping. You only drop a name if you can back it up and you are willing to do so to add value. Otherwise, it is douchey. So what I mean by that is, if Jason goes, man, you know, I really need to talk to somebody who started a tequila brand because my uncle is selling his tequila factory in Mexico. And I go, oh, you know what? I know the guys who do Casamigos tequila, George Clooney and his homeboy. I don't know. This is obviously BS, right?
Yeah, but, I hope so.
Well, yeah. You're like, when are we going down to hang with George?
Exactly. Where's my free tequila? And I want to hang out with George.
Well, where's your uncle's tequila factory?
Good point.
So then it makes sense because I go, why don't I hook your uncle up with his people? Does that make sense? Or, oh, you're doing something with such and such charity? I happen to know that Michael Phelps is really into those charities. Let me see if he'll be interested in what you're doing, or if his organization would be interested in teaming up with your organization. See, then it's a value add. That is a good kind of name drop because you're making an introduction. But if I just walk in and someone goes, man, you know, I'm doing this thing. And I go, well, I know Michael Phelps. And you go, well, that's great. Will he team up? No, I'm just saying, I know Michael Phelps. I'm pretty impressive, right? I mean, what are you doing with that name drop? You have to be able to back it up. Name dropping, most of the time, it's only for you. You want to gain points, but it backfires. You look ridiculous. You can name drop if you're willing to make that introduction or connection for the other person. So it's a value add for the other person. Only name drop if it's an offer and not a brag. If somebody goes, hey, Jordan, I really want to learn how to do XYZ. And I say, you know, I happen to know the best in the business. You want to learn how to speak from stage? I can hook you up with Tony Robbins' teacher because I've known Tony for a long time, which is also BS. Then it's like, great. Well, yeah, I would love that. But if I just say, yeah, I know Tony Robbins. He's really good at speaking. Oh, cool. Can you introduce me to his speaking coach? No. What are you doing there? There's really no other reason. And that's how most name dropping comes across. It's just absolutely ridiculous. So unless you're using it to illustrate how you can help someone else, don't do it. You look like an idiot.
Here's a scenario that I want to get your feedback on.
Yeah.
Say you're talking to somebody about, say, a skill that they want to learn, or a scenario where you have some intimate knowledge about how they can do it better, and your friend, who is the famous person that you are hanging out with, talking about this very same thing, can you then say, like, hey, I was hanging out with Tim Ferriss last week, and we were talking about this thing, and this is what Tim does, and then pass along the advice? That way there's no introduction involved, but you're using that name as a kind of like social proof to say, look, this is actually really good advice.
Yes.
This person does it. You should maybe think about doing it this way. You're still not doing an introduction, but you're kind of just, it's a name drop just to build in just some gravitas to the advice that you're going to give.
That's a really, really good question. You're right. Yes, it gives credibility to the advice. Because if I'd said something like, well, you know, I don't want to ever simplify anything, and I don't want to outsource anything because it doesn't work, and outsourcing is BS, and it's a bunch of trendy stuff that nobody who's successful does. And you might go, well, actually, you know, I was talking with Tim Ferriss the other day, and one of the things he does is he simplifies as much as possible, and he outsources everything. And I might go, oh, well, okay, he really knows what he's doing. I should probably listen to this. But if you just said, I have a very successful friend and he outsources everything, I might go, well, I don't care what your friend does. Who's your friend? Some guy who owns a dry cleaner? Screw you, Jason DeFilippo. Go back to your Mensa hangouts. You know, I don't really care. But if you know that's going to be persuasive, then it's a persuasion technique and it's designed to get me to listen to good advice. But you're not doing it to make yourself look good. You're doing it to give me advice that you know is effective for a problem that I'm having. So it still follows the value add rule, which is the core rule. It doesn't have to be an intro. That's just the more obvious value add, I guess. But you're right. The value add rule there is good too. It might also be something like, oh, well, I happen to know one of the best people who's great at selling used cars. And I might go, oh, well, I know a lot of people that are good at it. And you might go, no, I know the guy. Let's call him for advice. And then I go, okay, I'm listening to you now. Right? That is a value add. Anytime it's a value add for the other person, because usually name dropping, this isn't even being calculated. They're just going, I bet all these people in this room will be really impressed and approve of me and like me if I tell them that I know David Copperfield. Took me a long time to think of a celebrity right there. What the hell? It's designed to be approval-seeking behavior. When it's approval-seeking behavior, you're not impressing anyone. You're actually just torpedoing your own social status. So unless it's a value add, don't do it. And even then, I would say be careful. If it's sort of ambiguous, you don't want to say, oh, you're talking about speech coaching? Well, I know Tony Robbins, so let me know if anybody wants intros to his speaking coach. It's like, dude, nobody was asking for speaking coaches. We were just talking about people we knew who were good speakers. You don't have to brag about how you know Tony Robbins. You know, that kind of thing, you have to be careful. It has to be useful and not a veiled reason to name drop also.
I wish you'd have given me this advice when I first moved to Hollywood, because I was terrible with name dropping. And I think a lot of people are when they start to meet famous people or just somebody outside of their circle. I realize how dumb I looked when I would name drop, and I would do it all the time. And finally, somebody pulled me aside and said, dude, shut up. Don't do that anymore. And I'm like, why? Everybody here thinks you're an asshole now. I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
You have to have it beaten over the head. So I applaud this person for actually asking the question, because a lot of people just instinctively do it because they're so excited to know somebody famous now. And it's just like, oh, I can talk about this person and I'll use it everywhere I can. So just take it out of your vernacular. And I think it's very telling that you couldn't come up with a celebrity for a couple seconds there because you're so attuned to not name drop.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I guess I was pushing those people out of my mind at the time for that reason. Oh, another thing that you shouldn't do, this isn't a name drop, but this is one of those clever Hollywood ways of doing it. And I hear this in New York, I hear this in LA, I hear this in any sort of big city. People will pretend in a way that they're on a first name basis with somebody. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to think of this real life example that happened. This is a long time ago. A friend of mine, let's call her Erica because that's her name. She was talking about how she used to be a server at a bar and Cuba Gooding Jr. would come in all the time. And she'd go, yeah. And then I said, oh, Cuba, you're so funny. And I'm like, you're not on a first name basis with Cuba Gooding Jr. He probably has no idea who you are. Real talk. If he's not at that restaurant, he's not like, what's up, Erica? Be real. So doing that whole like informal thing where you're like, oh, yeah, I hang out with William Nye, the science guy, but I call him Bill. I mean, come on. It's just ridiculous. Everyone knows you're fronting. You look and sound ridiculous. Don't do it. Man, it's just, it is tempting though, you know? And I'm just glad that my good friend Dwayne Johnson snapped me out of that habit. You know what I mean, guys?
I know. Will Smith, he called you up in the middle of the night and said, Jordan, man, you got to quit dropping the Rock's names.
I know. He was just, and I'm like, oh, Fresh Prince. Please.
Yo, FP, what's up?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, don't do that stuff either. We're on to you. You don't have a nickname for somebody. I know you read it in People magazine. Don't do it. It's corny. Next up.
Dear J4, I'm working as a first-time physician at a very large academic hospital. Through your negotiating series and years of listening to your show, I was able to gain a clinical and innovative consulting position that's supposed to bridge the gap between the digital health innovators and the clinicians. It's a first-of-its-kind position, given this innovation department is one of the first in the nation. So right now, it's up to me to build my own structure within the university. I've built a bunch of contacts within both facets of my job and have started working on connecting resources to push forward old and new projects university-wide. My passion, network, and critical thinking abilities have been well-received by contacts. My goal is to build up to a more leadership role where I can help push projects and ideas forward. I worry, though, that I find myself educating or connecting resources for free without receiving any credit to the hospital and innovation administration. How can I continue to network and problem solve for my peers, but also start to lay the foundation of credibility with my accomplishments to build future and likely new leadership positions at my hospital? This is especially important given the fact that I'm in uncharted territory without any clear mentorship. Thank you. Signed, credit where credit is due.
Ah, yes, this is tricky. Would be nice if we could just lean on our work and that alone was good enough. But alas, we need to make sure that people see our value. So I've got some stealth, tricky ways that aren't too underhanded or aren't underhanded at all, frankly, to get credit for work if people aren't giving it to you or if it would be very kind of gauche or uncouth to ask for it, which it usually is. So what you can do is CC bosses and higher-ups on introductions and threads where you're contributing. Don't do too much of this, right? So if you are emailing somebody and they're like, hey, can you make those intros to those people? Or, hey, Jordan, great work on the Madigan account. Don't CC seven of your bosses and their bosses or BCC all those people and be like, thanks, yeah, it's been a real pleasure adding a tremendous amount of value to the company because everyone's like, got it. You know, you might be able to do that once. If you take it well, you might be able to CC your immediate boss and go, this is great. I'm really excited about this project. Thanks so much. I know that Bob, my supervisor, will be really keen to hear about this as well. I've CC'd him here. But don't do that 10 times a week because then you're just flooding your boss's inbox and they're like, this guy is super irritating. Why am I CC'd on all of his emails? It's such a waste of my time. You can also follow up with the boss or the boss's boss and make sure they get value from what you're doing. But there's a right way to do this. Following up with your boss works by saying, hey, just wanted to say we closed this Madigan account thing. I worked with all these other people from this other department. It was really, really useful for me to learn. I hope this was useful for the company. Let me know if you have any feedback about this. And the boss might just be like, great job. That's my feedback. That's what you want. You want them to sort of hammer that nail down just a little bit. What you don't want to do is try to get a meeting or send a bunch of emails to your boss's boss and be like, just so you know, I'm the kid that closed that Madigan account, right? Just want to make sure that I'm getting my limelight. You don't want to do that. Your boss is going to be annoyed by that. Your job is to make your boss look good. And yes, you want some of that credit, especially if you think your boss isn't giving it to you. So here's a way that you can do that. And you don't want to overuse this one either. What you can do, let's say you work at a hospital. You know where your boss's office is. You also probably know where your boss's boss's office is. You could accidentally run into that person at the gym, at the elevator bank near the wherever office they work. You could just be walking by their office one day, especially if their door is open. Greet them and say, hey, how's that Madigan account going? I know that we set that up and it had a lot of moving parts. I hope that's really valuable. I know we worked a lot for a couple of weeks on that. How's that going? Do you need any other help with it? Can I be valuable in any way? And that person might go, oh, you worked on that. Well, no, that worked out really well. What's your name? Oh, nice to meet you. That's how you get credit for it. You don't demand it. You don't shove it in people's faces. You don't make 7,000 copies and send it through interoffice mail. You don't BCC the whole staff on your congratulatory email. You make it nice and stealth, but not underhanded, right? You're just being low key about it. Just enough so that people notice you, not a bunch so that you're the center of attention. That's the rule. And let people know you're the one that set it up and you got it in motion without you looking like you're whining because you didn't get credit for something or you want more limelight. It's very tactful and you should keep it that way as much as possible. Don't show up 3 times a week and be like, hey, just wanted to check in on that Madigan account. Like, let it go, man. You got plenty more work ahead of you. Your boss is going to look good as a result. You're going to get more responsibility. This is the long game. You're not going to have one big project and then get selected to win an Oscar in digital healthcare or whatever. So I'm not saying you're doing that, but I do get wanting credit. I'm just saying you don't want to sort of suffer in silence. You can get credit where credit is due, but you don't want to make this all about you and a mission to increase your profile every single day. You got to make sure you're working for the company, not for yourself exclusively.
We'll be right back with more Feedback Friday right after this.
This episode is sponsored in part by Zoom.
When you use Zoom, every day is a little better. Zoom video conferencing lets you connect face-to-face with anyone across town or around the world with flawless video, clear audio, and instant sharing of files, video, anything. And you can connect through any device, desktop, laptop, tablet, smartphone, or conference room system. Zoom video conferencing, Zoom rooms, Zoom video webinars, and Zoom phone put state-of-the-art tech at your fingertips and lets you do business at the speed of Zoom. Look, if you're not using Zoom video communications, the only question I have is, why not? I'll make it super easy for you. Visit Zoom online and set up a free account today. Try the most affordable and most reliable video communication solution on the market. Meet happy with Zoom.
This episode is also sponsored by Calm, something I rarely am, in fact. Are you struggling to sleep these days? Well, yes, I am, actually, because I have a 1-month-old. But if you're struggling to sleep and it's not because you have a baby crying in your ear, well, you're not alone. 1 in 3 U.S. adults doesn't get enough sleep. And if you're not sleeping enough, it can affect your cognitive functions during the day, like learning, problem solving, decision making, and not wanting to kill everyone that's around you. That's why we're partnering with Calm, the number one app for sleep. Sleep deficiency does some serious damage, and not just to your brain, but to your body as well. The sleepless are prone to more accidents, weight gain, depression. We talked about this when we talked with Dr. Matthew Walker about how teenagers are more likely to get in a crash from lack of sleep than anything else. With Calm, you've got a whole library of programs designed to help you get the sleep your brain and body needs, like soundscapes, over 100 sleep stories narrated by soothing voices like Jerome Flynn from Game of Thrones, Stephen Fry. So you want to seize the day, sleep the night with the help of Calm. And I know we got a deal for him, Jay.
Right now, our listeners get 25% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/Jordan. That's calm.com/Jordan for 25% off your premium subscription. 40 million people have downloaded Calm. Find out why at calm.com/Jordan. Thank you for supporting the show. Your support of our advertisers keeps us on the air. To learn more and get links to all the great discounts you just heard, visit jordanharbinger.com/deals. Now back to the show for the conclusion of Feedback Friday.
Okay, moving right along.
Hi, Team Harbinger. I reached out to someone who's in the field I want to be in, and she referred me to 2 other people that agreed to meet with me. I researched what they do a little bit, but I don't feel confident. I want to know more about what they do, but I also don't want to waste their time since this will be our first time meeting. I wanted to use your few technique, but was wondering if there is anything else I should do. Thanks. Need some recon.
For those of you that haven't tuned in for the past couple weeks of Feedback Friday, Few is in our six-minute networking course. It's a rapport curve. It's a conversation outline or map that shows you how to create deeper rapport with people and keep conversations going in a way that's interesting. If you're not in the six-minute networking course, by the way, the Few technique, I did it as a bonus video. So if you've already gone through the course or you want to use it right away, just go to jordanharbinger.com/course. You don't have to go through the whole course again to get it. It's in the bonus section. The whole Few rapport curve is outlined there. And we talked about it in the previous weeks of Feedback Friday as well. So what I would do if I were in your situation is use LinkedIn and see if you know any of their colleagues that you could ask about them as well. If you don't, that's one thing, that's fine. But you can glean a lot of info from people's colleagues. You can glean a lot of info from LinkedIn and social media. When you meet them, one of the first things I would say is, hey, I did my best to find out more about what you do. I looked at LinkedIn. I looked at the company website and your profile there. But frankly, I didn't find much about what it looks like you're currently working on. And then you can start the conversation that way. It doesn't have to be the first thing you say, but it can be one of the first things before you start asking questions. This way, if you ask something they think is kind of a silly question, like, oh man, you don't even know that I work in accounts receivable and that I'm on the collections team? What's going on there? You might know that, but not know what they do. Then by saying this, they know you tried to find the right answer first and that you're not just lazy. And that is going to go a long way. What you don't want is for them to go, let me get this straight. I took time out of my day to meet you for coffee and you don't know that I work at LinkedIn and not Facebook. What am I doing here? You don't know I moved from Tesla back to Ford? Hello, is this thing on? I already know I'm wasting my time. I'm going to shut my brain off and just look for an excuse to get out. You do not want that to happen. One note though, if they're a public figure of any kind, or I hate this word, but influencer, right? The measuring stick is different. So when somebody emails me, and I get this every week or every day, emails me or something in my LinkedIn inbox, people go, what made you want to start the show? Or, oh, what do you do? I just go, all right, you've done zero research. I'm going to have to put a bunch of energy into this interaction. There's probably nothing in it for me. I often just ignore those. If I'm in person and I'm with a bunch of friends at a bar and somebody doesn't know me and they say, what do you do? I'm not going to be like, how dare you, right? Google me. I'm not going to do that.
Don't you know who I am, sir?
Don't you know who I am? Yeah, I'm not going to do that. But if somebody sends me a message on LinkedIn or Instagram, and this is where I typically get these, oh, what do you do? I'm like, you literally could click on my profile and find that out. Why would I answer this? I'm just going to end up wasting a bunch of time talking with you. You can't even click on my effing profile and read it, but you're just going to ask me? That is a sort of loser mentality. That's like a lazy, entitled mentality. Granted, if somebody's just making conversation with you in real life, it's a different story. But if somebody wants information from you and they won't even look at your social media profiles, which is like table stakes for engaging in a conversation online, then I will genuinely and generally ignore everything they have to say after that. And so you want to avoid falling into that trap.
You turn into a professional blocker because you just hit block over and over again.
Yep. I don't block people, but I do have, luckily, Instagram has two inboxes now. I don't know if everybody has this, but there's general and priority. It's so helpful. So I can basically push people I don't know or that I don't really like engaging with to general, and they just sit there until I'm bored one day laying on my couch watching Netflix, and I pick up my phone, and I can go through there and just sort of archive stuff or answer stuff with like a cut and paste. I'm thinking about making a shortcut on my phone that just answers that. This isn't really a value for too many people here, but if you get a lot of inquiries that are useless, I would say make a keyboard shortcut, use Text Expander or, you know, the shortcuts on your phone, and it says something like, hey, thanks for the question. If you're interested in getting to know more about my business, click here. Here's my website. Here's my profile on the company website. Best of luck. Bye. I should just do something like that. A lazy question can yield a lazy answer, and I don't feel bad about that at all.
Exactly.
All right. Last but not least.
Hi, Jordan, Jen, and Jason. I'm a healthcare practitioner with 5 years of work experience, and I'm currently part of a big project on electronic medical record implementation in Canada. I truly enjoy the business process and administration side of my job and would like to further advance my career. Healthcare practitioners typically have professional designations in addition to their degrees, like occupational therapist, medical doctor, registered nurse, social worker, etc. And most professionals in administration have a master's degree as well, like an MSc, an MHA, and a lot of other three-letter acronyms. I would like to know your opinion on Scott Galloway's advice on obtaining credentials early in your career to maximize on your economic growth, knowing that an MBA is a big investment or debt, which is approximately $50,000 to $60,000 Canadian solely on tuition. Is it worth the ROI? Or do you think we are progressing so quickly that conventional education is becoming outdated as more and more people are able to learn free online and obtain necessary skills from experience without a formal education? I know you are formally trained as a lawyer who is a very successful podcast host with no formal broadcasting or media background. Keep up the great work. Signed, do I really need the letters?
Ugh, yeah, I feel your pain here. In many situations, I'd say you probably don't need the letters. Hell, I know of engineers, I think one wrote in recently, last week maybe, Jason, who didn't even get an engineering degree, but her work stood out and she's doing amazing. That said, law, business, and obviously medicine are fields where you often need the letters. And I would actually ask higher-ups in your organization that aren't in your direct chain of command. So don't ask your boss or your boss's boss, but somebody just outside. The reason for this is their answers aren't going to be tainted by them possibly being threatened by you advancing. Because what you don't want is to ask your boss and you find out later that your boss said, you don't need to go to business school, knowing full well that you do because they don't want you to go to business school because they're not willing to go to business school and they want to keep you beneath them and not get you promoted over them. You want somebody who doesn't have any conflict of interest in giving you good advice. So you really don't want somebody to give you life-altering advice based on their own insecurities or what they want for themselves. That's real bad. Also, I would do informal informational interviews of people whose jobs you want in 5 years. You can do these on the phone, meetings if you can get them. Hell, stop by their office. It should be pretty easy because you're already in the company. You can straight up say, you can walk by someone's office and say, hey, you don't really know me. I'm several rungs below you on the ladder. But if I wanted to work with you or in the role that you've got now after you move up, let's say in 5 years, what path would you prescribe for me? Do I need an MBA to get there? You could have this conversation in the elevator. Hi, I know that you're head of HR and I'm just working in this other department, but I'd like to transfer over there. What do I need to be in your shoes in 5 years? Most people aren't going to be threatened by that because they're not going to be in that role in 5 years, given any luck. That's why you say also, what if I wanted to work with you? Because then it doesn't say, what if I want your job? And they're like, oh my God, right? What if I want to work with you or in the role you've got now after you move up? That's key. It says, I'm not looking for your job while you want it. I'm looking for your job after you don't need it. What do I need to get there? I would gladly tell somebody what they needed to do, let's say at a law firm. You need a law degree. Then you need to do this, 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 and this. It's non-threatening. You want to make it non-threatening and make sure they don't have a conflict of interest. That's, again, why you don't ask your own boss. The question is also more what the institution requires. Yes, we're moving fast as a society. Yes, formal education is starting to be exposed as the overvalued, in many ways, semi-scam that it often is, especially with these for-profit colleges and all this other BS. But that doesn't mean that a large company like a hospital or medical system is going to change their rules that fast. Also, often degrees are a proxy for how hard you're willing to work and if you have the smarts to handle the job. They don't care if you do what the degree required. They just care that you're willing to work your butt off and can get the work done. So you might be able to prove this in the office, but the institution might say, requirements for this position are, at minimum, this, 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 and this. You don't want to be in a situation where it's nearly impossible for you to get promoted because the company policy is that you have an MBA. So now you're stuck, and then you've got to do a job for another 3 or 4 years that you're overqualified for while you get letters. Get the letters before you need the letters. Otherwise, you're going to be stuck in a role because you're going to hit a ceiling. So yes, the degree is expensive, but often organizations will pay for it. So ask the same people you're meeting with, or ask HR or whoever might handle this, does the company, does the hospital have a tuition reimbursement system that you can take advantage of? You never know. It could end up being a quote-unquote free from your employer, which is great. Employers would love to pay for it because it means they can retain you longer. It's also a little bit of job security. Kind of sucks to get rid of somebody if you have to pay their tuition, right? So you might be last in any layoff lines if they know that you've got to stick around because they paid for your tuition. So it could be a little job security there. That said, it's going to be a tough after-work program and a tough few years to do an executive MBA like that. But it might be worth it economically at the end of the day. You have to game this out long game. Will the company pay for it? If so, that's a different calculation. If you have to pay for it, well, okay, let's say it costs you 30 grand. how many years in a higher paid position do you need to work before that breaks even for you? 4, 5, 6 years? How long are you going to work there? 30, 40 years? You know, do the math. You've really got to game it out and do the math and find out what's available to you. And best of luck out there, Gunner. Life pro tip of the week. When you get a scammy or spam phone call, you can tell them, oh, I think you have the wrong number. This is a government office. I heard this trick recently, Jason, and they will often hang up immediately, especially if it's an illegal phone call. Like, you know, you're on the do not call list. You know, it's one of those, oh, this is the IRS. I used to get dozens of calls a day. I still get a handful, but a lot of people that I know have also been using this tactic, and the calls, they say they've dropped down to 1 to 2 a week. You know, they hear the words government office and they hang up. I'm already on the do not call list. All of you are probably on the do not call list, but it doesn't do anything. Somebody who's going to break the law and tell you they're the IRS, they don't care if you're on the do not call list. Give me a break.
Yeah, it's useless.
Yeah, it's useless. I wish you all the best of luck in the battle against scammers. And Jason, you've got a technical trick that seems to be pretty genius.
Yeah, remember when you call somebody, you hear the doo-doo-doot, this line has been disconnected. Please call again or call somebody else. That three-tone doo-doo-doo is a trigger for a lot of these robocallers. You know, it's an automated system. They're listening for you. If it hears that, it automatically takes your number out of the pool because they don't want to be spending their time on a dead number. So if you have a voicemail, you just start it with those three sounds, the ding, 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 and then just go into your regular voicemail. Say, hey, this is Jason. Thanks for calling. You know, call me back later or text me because I hate answering the phone. So if you put that try sound into it, which I'm assuming will be in the show right here, then you can actually start to programmatically remove yourself from these lists. And it has worked for me.
So do you do the and then you play that for a bit, and then after that you go, don't leave me a voicemail. I never check this. It's still Jason. Send me a text for humans.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Because you don't want people that you know who think they're leaving you a message to go, oh, your number changed. It's like, no. That's for computers.
Yeah, it's so fast that nobody's really going to hear it. And, you know, it's just they process it for a second. But when your voice comes on, it just, you know, says, hey, leave me a message or text me.
Cool. I like that trick.
Yep, it works.
Recommendation of the week, Dave Chappelle, Sticks and Stones. I normally don't recommend comedy. It's very subjective. I don't like slapstick or absurd comedy at all, but I think Dave Chappelle is a legit comic genius. He's not for everyone, as a no comedian ever is, but takes on gun culture, the opioid crisis, the tidal wave of celebrity scandals, and he's also got his share of stuff. I mean, he fled, right? When Chappelle's show was at its peak 10 years ago, he just vanished.
Yeah, he took off to Africa and said, I'm out. Peace.
Yeah, and this comedy is awesome. And at the end, Jason, I don't know if you watched the, he's just got like extras or something, and he talked about why he left, but he goes, I'm going to talk about why I left, but I can't do it directly. And he tells a story about Iceberg Slim, the pimp. When you read between the lines, you're like, oh, really
interesting.
Good. I might be mistaken. It might be his previous special, but there's a bonus where he's just chilling in front of an audience of legit like 40 people at a comedy club.
Oh, yeah. That was his previous special. Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah. So he's got a epilogue, if you will. And he's like, all right, I'm going to tell you what happened, but I can't say it directly. And he tells a story about Iceberg Slim, the pimp, and how in the book Pimp, which he was reading, it hit him hard, and that's what caused him to quit. And he talks about how Iceberg controls the girls that work with him, the prostitutes that work with him. And it's very enlightening. And it sort of gives you insight to Hollywood, and you go, oh, is that what happened? Dude, you got to rewatch this. It's so interesting. Obviously, it's psychology. That's what pimps use. They use like very manipulative, dark psychology.
I do remember that because I actually went out and bought the book. It's in my Kindle, and I never went back and read it. So now I got to go back and read that book. Thanks for the homework, Jordan.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome. Yeah. So that's on Netflix, Sticks and Stones. I think it's hilarious. If you hate it, don't blame me.
Yeah, there's a lot of controversy about this one, but my roommate and I absolutely loved every second of it. This is one of the best hours in comedy ever. And also, since you're a Chappelle fan, Jordan, I put this in here for you. I'm not a huge fan of comedians in cars getting coffee, but there is a Dave Chappelle episode, and it is great. It's only like 15, 20 minutes. Highly recommend checking it out.
Why don't you like comedians in cars getting coffee?
I'm not a Jerry Seinfeld fan.
That'll do it.
Yep. Easy enough.
Yep. Hope you all enjoyed that. I want to thank everyone that wrote in this week. Going to have some live events probably next year, doing corporate training now, which is really fun. Got some awesome Silicon Valley clients. A link to the show notes for this episode can be found at jordanharbinger.com. Quick shout out to David Gray Lassiter. He did the 6-minute networking exercises, transitioned from academia to the corporate world, had a lot of idea about what 6-minute networking was. I don't need this. I'm good at networking. I don't really want to do this. I don't want to have to worry about this. He learned the hard way that, hey, look, having negative judgments about people who network and things like that, that's not serving me. That's not helping me. That's an excuse process. So thanks so much, David. Big shout out to you for being flexible enough to change your mind about something and learn a useful set of lessons in the process. And I wonder how many people haven't done or checked out 6-minute networking because they think they don't need it. People who network, oh, they're lazy, they're brown nosing, or I'm already good at this. If that's you, dig into 6-minute networking, jordanharbinger.com/course. It's free. And most of the people I know that are really good at networking, they dive in and they're like, I love this. And people I know that are not good at it, but think they are, they're like, oh, I don't need this. I'm really good at this. By the way, do you know anybody who can help me get out of this rut that I'm in? And I'm like, wow, the irony here. Go back and check out the guests, Wendy Bahari and Chris Bailey, if you haven't yet. I'm on Instagram and Twitter at Jordan Harbinger. It's a great way to engage with the show. Videos of our interviews are at jordanharbinger.com/YouTube. And Jason, you've got your own show.
You can check out my tech podcast, Grumpy Old Geeks, at gog.show. And if you're a podcaster, check out The Club. It's a place for podcasters just to chill out and discuss business and craft without Mark Zuckerberg looking over your shoulder. That's at club.podcastschool.co. It's free and open to everyone.
This show was created in association with Podcast One, and this episode was produced by Jen Harbinger, edited by Jay Sanderson, and show notes for the episode are by Robert Fogarty. Music by Evan Viola. Keep sending in those questions to friday@jordanharbinger.com. Our advice and opinions and those of our guests are their own. And yes, I'm a lawyer, but I'm not your lawyer. So do your own research before implementing anything you hear on the show. And remember, we rise by lifting others. So share the show with those you love and even those you don't. We've got a lot more in the pipeline and very excited to bring it to you. In the meantime, do your best to apply what you hear on the show so you can live what you listen. And we'll see you next time.
Be sure to check out the new Launchpad DM podcast, Podcasting Made Simple. Every week, the host answers your question and gives out tips to make your podcast lives simple without the headaches and needing fancy equipment. Get your podcast out there and sound great without breaking the bank. The show is available now on LaunchpadDM.com. Step one, if you have a podcast or want to create one, don't forget to check out the new free hosting platform with support from Podcast One. Tune in to Podcasting Made Simple or sign up with your own podcast now at LaunchpadDM.com.